The only reason we stopped at nine lies is the publisher said there wasn't enough newsprint if I didn't stop at nine. So that's why. But it's the same lies that are still being told. Let me begin by citing, as others have done already, from the works of Alexis de Tocqueville. In Volume 1, Tocqueville writes, and I think this has great application to the United States, I quote, "I will never admit that men constitute a social body simply because they obey the same head and the same laws. Society can exist only when a great number of men consider a great number of things under the same aspect, when they hold the same opinions upon many subjects, and when the same occurrences suggest the same thoughts and impressions in their minds." Some three decades later, Tocqueville would have witnessed the bloody documentation of his insight at Fort Sumter, at Gettysburg, at Bull Run. Slavery and abolitionism had transformed what had once been for Tocqueville an admirable social body into an anarchy in which Americans no longer held the same opinions upon many subjects. Now the same occurrences suggested different and uncompromisable thoughts and impressions in their minds. In other words, for a society to be at peace with itself, there must be a minimal set of values that a population reveres and is determined to protect against those who would subvert or overturn those values. There are certain values, then, that are beyond compromise. This is not to suggest that the majority has the right to impose majoritarian values upon those who do not revere them, but the minority must accept, today it does not, and or respect, today it most certainly does not, certain of those majoritarian values. These values are not necessarily to be accepted simply because there is a majority for them. No, these values simply are those which make society viable. Without them, we are in a Hobbesian universe, the war of all against all. And who better demonstrated the importance of values than the Reverend Jesse Jackson when he confessed publicly a few months ago, and I quote, "There is nothing more painful for me at this stage in my life than to walk down the street and hear footsteps and start to think about robbery and then look around and see it's somebody white and feel relieved. How humiliating." Unquote. Now, would I be able to say that I walked down the street and heard footsteps and then looked around and saw that was somebody who was not white? Relieved? No. Humiliating? Hardly. Ominous? Frightening? You bet. 6 months ago, Reverend Jackson told the students at New York City's Martin Luther King High School, quote, "We lose more lives annually to the crime of blacks killing blacks than the sum total of lynchings in the entire history of the country." Reverend Jackson asked those of his audience of some 700 students, "Who knows someone in your age group who is dead because of drugs? Stand up." About a quarter of the audience stood. "If they knew of someone who had distributed drugs at school, stand up." 25%. "If they knew of someone who had carried a gun in school, stand up." 40%. How many in the audience had told a teacher or someone in authority that student so-and-so was dealing drugs or carrying a gun? Please stand. Nobody stood. A useful sermon from Reverend Jackson. Yet when Sister Soldier in 1992 said, "Why not have a week and kill white people?" the same Reverend Jackson hedged. And Congressman Charles Rangel said that Bill Clinton's criticism of Soldier was insulting. Why not have a week and kill white people? and black elite leadership, mainstream leadership, was as groveling as it has been in its response to the frenetic anti-Semitic rhetoric of the Reverend Louis Farrakhan. Let me recall to mainstream black leadership something the courageous black labor leader A. Philip Randolph said half a century ago. I quote, "The Negro must be hitched up in the fight against anti-Semitism because he must understand that anti-Semitism and anti-Negroism stem from the same source," unquote. Would the Reverend Chavez, the extremist head of the NAACP, agree with Phil Randolph? I doubt it. Mainstream African-American leadership rejects these facts. First, no other country in the world is doing as much to solve the problem of race as the United States. More federal, state, or municipal money is being thrown at the problem of black ethnicity than at AIDS or housing or any other social problem. And it is black ethnicity we're talking about. Ethnicity is no serious predicament for Asians or for Latinos or other American minorities. I defy Reverend Jackson, Congressman Rangel, or any other member of the Black Caucus, or any black spokesman to cite another country which is doing, not trying to do, actually doing as much to change black-white relations for the better as the United States. The United States is the only country in the world which this question is asked. Are things getting worse in the United States? Never are things getting better. Fact number two, as decent, unracist Americans, we must rid ourselves of the blame whitey guilt syndrome, which is the curse of interracial relations. Black leadership lives by the slogan which characterizes the Marxist left and was so well defined by Kenneth Minogue, quote, "The only improvement of anything is the improvement of everything." Let's stop cringing. The strategy of today's black leadership is this: concede nothing good has happened to improve the lot of Afro-Americans since the Civil War. In fact, everything is getting worse. And if things are getting worse, then there is no hope, is there, except to throw another couple of billion dollars into the non-melting pot. Let me give you an example of what's being said today on campuses of major prestige universities. Let me read you a quote from the Stanford University Daily, the student paper, just a few months ago. This is a report of a speech by a professor in the Spanish, Portuguese, and African and Afro-American Studies Department. And the story begins, quote, "Just as black men and women were lynched in the past, young black men and women are being lynched every day in the United States," Professor Sylvia Winter said last night in a discussion with students in Robel Hall. Professor Winter said America is lynching black people by destroying the stability of the inner city and negating the existence of black people in society. Winter said, "Joblessness and the so-called war on drugs and crime is destroying the inner city. I am, quote, I am so afraid of an Auschwitz happening in America," she said. Well, at least she wasn't denying the Holocaust, which is something in our favor. Let me conclude with a first-hand experience last June when I attended the commencement at Milton Academy as a proud grandfather of a graduating Japanese-American granddaughter. The commencement speaker was a highly successful black Boston lawyer. Behind him sat the headmaster of Milton Academy, a black educator who has not only been a successful fundraiser, but has created in this once traditional New England prep school a rainbow coalition student body and faculty. Seated in the front row of the platform alongside the speaker was a 17-year-old black, the head monitor elected in a competitive secret election. This head monitor is now a Yale freshman. And what was the theme of the commencement speaker? 3 points. There was not yet in America a consensus on racism and civil rights. Racism is still widespread in the United States, and there didn't seem to be too much hope for future improvement. Now, I am not suggesting that because the headmaster at a prestigious New England prep school or the commencement day speaker and the head monitor are African Americans that America's paradise regained. What I am suggesting is that it is the height of irresponsibility to ignore the consensus on racism that most assuredly does exist today in America. Congress, White House, Supreme Court, and most of our state and local governments, in the media, in private and public schools and universities, Wall Street, corporations, and churches. For a lawyer especially to ignore the evidence before his very eyes and to bemoan the lack of consensus before students at Milton Academy, and bemoan the lack of consensus in America, is to discourage the hopes and dreams of those who have been fighting for civil rights going back 2 or 3 generations, to the pioneering heroism of labor leader A. Philip Randolph, or the memorable crusade of Bayard Rustin, or the unyielding strategies of Roy Wilkins and another black lawyer, Thurgood Marshall. And oh yes, who was the lawyer who spoke at Milton Academy's commencement last June and said there is no hope? He was the present Assistant Attorney General of the United States in charge of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, Deval Patrick. Let us pray.